This morning I'd like to dedicate this year Iloi Nishmas Yair Almalei, a friend of mine who passed away this past week. Yair Almalei, Zal, a friend of mine who passed away this past week. Parshat B'Shalach opens at a very dramatic and crucial moment in the history of Bnei Israel. They have just exited from the land of Egypt, and they feel that they can finally breathe their first few breaths of freedom, and yet there is more of an exodus in store for them. We open the parsha on your source sheets, number one, with a psukim, Vayihi B'Shalach Paro Es Ha'am, V'lo Nacham Elokim Derech Eretz Plishtim. And it was when Paro sent the nation that Hashem did not allow them to exit the land through Eretz Plishtim, which would have been a straight exit. Ki karovhu. Remember, they think that right now they're about to enter the land of Israel. They don't know yet about 40 years in the Midbar. So the plan A, is that they're going directly from Mitzrayim and they're going to go straight into Eretz Israel. But Hashem does not allow them to have this straight path. Rather, or because, ki amar Elokim, pen yanachem ha'am berosam melchama v'shavu Mitzrayimam. Because Hashem doesn't want them to be too close to Egypt. He wants them to go on a more circuitous path so that they shouldn't get afraid, they shouldn't fear the pending war with the Egyptians who are about to pursue them. They shouldn't panic and they shouldn't flee with an easy exit route, escape route, back to Egypt. So instead, Hashem makes them take a more circuitous path. Derech Hamidbar Yam Suf v'chamushim alu b'nei Yisrael me'aretz Mitzrayim. So he sent them along a different path, and it's interesting because the pasuk actually reveals the chamushim alu. They were even armed. They did have armor. They were ready to do battle. And yet psychologically, the slave nation was not ready to launch war, to wage war with their own adversaries who for over two centuries had enslaved them. So what we have here is very purposeful setting of the stage by God of what's going to happen. Fast forward a couple of psukim, and Hashem has a conversation with Moshe Rabbeinu, and again, he sets the stage. He tells Moshe what's about to occur in the head and in the mind of Paro. V'amar Paro l'bnei Yisrael, nevuchem heim ba'aretz, sagar lehem hamidbar. And Paro will erroneously think that they are enclosed by the desert, and that they're lost, and that they lost their way in the desert. V'chizakti yaslev Paro v'radach achareihem. And I will harden Paro's heart one last time, and he will pursue them. V'ikavda b'Paro. And the reason why I am going to, for the last time, harden Paro's heart and make him pursue Bnei Yisrael is that I will be glorified. V'ikavda m'lashem kavod. I will be glorified through Paro. V'chalchelo, and all of his chariots and army, v'yedu Mitzrayim ki ani Hashem yukevakevi, and therefore all of Egypt will finally see that I am God. So in other words, Hashem is setting up the grand finale. This will be the last stand. V'yasu kein, and indeed this occurs. V'yugad l'melech Mitzrayim ki barach ha'am v'yehafach levav paro v'avadav el ha'am. And it is told to Paro that the Jews have escaped, and he and his servants' hearts change, and they start to regret, what did we do by letting this nation escape? Vayomu mazos asinu ki shalachnu es Yisrael me'avdinu. Vayasar es rechvo ve'es amo lakachimo. And Paro himself harnesses his chariot. He is going to get them. Vayikach sheish mios rechav bachur, and he takes the elite of his troops, the best of the best, v'kol rechav Mitzrayim v'shileishim al bulo. There are, you know, warriors and army captains. The entire force of the Egyptian army is now going to pursue them. Vayechazak Hashem es leiv paro melech Mitzrayim v'yirdach acharei b'nei Yisrael, b'nei Yisrael yetzim b'yad ramah. And Hashem hardens Paro's heart and the hearts of all of the Mitzrayim, and they pursue Bnei Yisrael. Vayudifu Mitzrayim Acharim, vayasigu osam chonim ahayam, kolsos rechav Paro farasha v'chilo al pihachiros lefnei Baal Tzifon. And the army of Paro finds Bnei Yisrael camping at this location, al pihachiros lefnei Baal Tzifon, two locations within the desert. Now it's building up the momentum and the drama that this is a massive, massive army. And remember, this was a nation that was enslaved for over two centuries. Next, Pasuk, Yud, Uparo hakriv vayis'u b'nei Yisrael, and Paro is coming nearer, and b'nei Yisrael, vayis'u b'nei Yisrael es einehem, and b'nei Yisrael lift their eyes, v'hinei Mitzrayim nasa acharehem, and behold, they see the entire war force of Egypt pursuing them. Sus rechav Paro, no, I'm in the wrong pasuk. Vayir'u ma'od, and they are terrified, vayitzak'u b'nei Yisrael el Hashem. And they start crying out to Hashem. Now, there are a lot of interpretations of what exactly is going on in Bnei Yisrael at this particular moment. But one thing is clear. There is panic, there is fear, there is terror. There are those who, vayitzaku, as a language of yelling, they're screaming at Hashem, which the psukim and the pshat itself will support in the next couple of psukim. They are just angry. Why did we come out of Egypt? What did we need this for? We're all going to perish anyway. And then there are those, vayitzaku el Hashem, milashem tfila. They're actually praying to Hashem. They're davening. So the reactions are very varied at this particular moment. Look at Pasuk Yud Aleph, Vayomu al Moshe, the screamers, the yellers, say to Moshe, Hamibli ein kfarim b'mitzrayim, lekachtanu lamos b'midbar, there weren't enough graves in the land of Egypt that you had to take us out to the desert to die this miserable death here. Mazal sasisa lanu lahutziyanu b'mitzrayim. What did you do by taking us out of Egypt? Halo zehadavar asher dibarnu elecha b'mitzrayim. Isn't this what exactly we said to you, precisely what we said to you when we were in Egypt? Lemar, chadal mimenu, v'na'avda es Mitzrayim. Leave us alone already, Moshe, when he kept prophesying that they were going to exit. Leave us alone already. Let's just stay here. It's better to be alive as an enslaved nation than dead in the Midbar. We're not capable of actually exiting Egypt. Ki tov lanu avod es Mitzrayim v'nuseinu b'midbar. Pasuk Gimel, v'yomer Moshe, El ha'am, al tira'u. But Moshe says to the people, do not fear. Hisyatzu ura'u es Yeshua's Hashem. Asher ya'asa lachem hayom. Stand and behold the salvation of God, that God will do for you. Ki asher re'isem es Mitzrayim hayom. Because just as you see the Egyptians today, lo sosifu lerosam od ad olam. I promise you, just as real as they are and palpable a force as they are to you right now, today is the last day you will ever see from them. Hashem, Pasuk Gedalad, Hashem yilachem lachem v'atem tacharishun. God will do the fighting for you, and you be quiet. So this is the way Moshe is working the crowd control. He's, in a sense, reassuring them, there will be the miracles of all miracles. This will be the last stand. You just wait and see. You've never seen something so miraculous, even though you've seen all of the makos and the very dramatic vayihi b'chatzos halayla when we exited Egypt itself. You ain't seen nothing yet. This is really what's going to happen. And he's, in a sense, calming them down, but in another sense, he's giving them muster. Keep quiet. Don't be such, you know, ingrates. Hashem will take you out. You got this far. You're going to get further. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, matit. Pasuk Tesvav, Vayomer Hashem al Moshe, Ma Tetzach Elai, Dabero B'nei Yisrael V'yisu. And then suddenly there seems to be a gap in the narration here. One pasuk ago, we have Moshe talking directly to the people. But then there's a little bit of a shift, and Hashem starts to yell at Moshe, give Moshe a little bit of Moser, why are you crying to me? Tetzach here in the Lashon of Tefillah, the language of Tefillah. Why are you davening to me? Speak to Bnei Yisrael and march onward, march forth. Now, remember, they're in this little enclosed part of the Midbar. Behind them, they have the entire war force of Egypt bearing down on them. In front of them, they have a raging sea. Precisely where were they supposed to march onward, march forward? This command of forward march was even lost on Moshe Rabbeinu himself. Incidentally, to address that gap in the text, Rashi tells us that after Moshe controls the crowd, he then turns to Hashem and says, okay, now what? I'm controlling them, I'm calming them down, but what exactly am I supposed to do with these people? Where are we supposed to go? And Hashem yells at him, this is not the time for prayer. This is the time for action. Vayis'u, travel. The last pasuk here, Tassayin va'ata, harim es matcha uneteyat yatcha al hayam. And you, Moshe, lift your matev, your stick, spread your hand over the Yamsuf, the Red Sea, uvika ehu, and split it. Vayavo b'nei Yisrael betoch hayam b'yabasha. And B'nai Yisrael will enter the dry land after you split the sea. So here is a concrete, tangible command that Hashem gives to Moshe, and real instruction as to how to, you know, forward march, how to get these people out of the situation. Now, there is a very famous midrash that's brought down in many, many midrashim, many different sources, about a certain individual who in this situation of panic and chaos and fear, actually does take the initiative to initiate the redemption for Bnei Yisrael. And this is the figure of Nachshon ben Aminadav. And he is very, very famous to us precisely for this one act of bravery and courage, this magnificent moment in the history of humanity where a single man sees everyone fighting around him, panicking around him. The leader himself, Moshe Rabbeinu, is a little bit clueless at this time. He himself doesn't know how to lead. And Nachshon ben Aminadab steps forward to take control of the situation and wades into the water. And we are told that in his schus, the waters split and all of the nation followed him through the waters. We learn in Pirkei Avos, a famous dictum, "B'makom she'ein ish, hishtagel hiyos ish." In a place where there is no man, strive to be the man. What does this mean metaphorically? In a place where there is no leader, you fill the leadership void. And this is exactly what Nachshon ben Aminadab does. Incidentally, just to bring this down to her own level for a minute, it's very interesting to analyze this in very human terms of different people's reactions to a crisis. There are some who complain, the complainers, Hamibliyeng, Farim, and Mitzrayim. Then there are the daveners. Oh, I believe Hashem is going to, you know, give us a Yeshua from this situation, and I'm davening. And then there are the doers. There are the actors. I believe and I act, and I'm going to concretize my belief in the form of an action that will prove my belief. This is the Nachshon ben Aminadav, and this is today the midah, the character trait, which I would like to analyze, which really comprises the character of the true leader and of a king. So, the source that I've chosen to share with you that provides a little bit of a lengthy analysis of this act of Nachshon ben Aminadav is the Gemara in Sota, source number 2. The Gemara is actually in the midst of a different discussion. The discussion that it had started with was a discussion about how two of the Shvatim, two of the brothers, or two of the sons of Yaakov, had sanctified Hashem's name in public. They had made a Kiddush Hashem. So the first brother they talk about is Yosef, and the Gemara goes on for several pages discussing how Yosef sanctified Hashem's name in public, and then it speaks about Yehuda. So the Gemara opens, Yehuda Maihi, and Yehuda, how did he sanctify Hashem's name in public? Ditanya, as we learn in Ebraisa, Haya Rabbi Meir Omer. Rabbi Meir says, Kisha'am bi Yisrael al Hayam, when Bnei Yisrael were standing at the banks of the shore of the Yamsuf, Hayu Shvatim Menatzchem Ze Im Ze. The tribes were all competing with one another. They were vying with one another. Ze Omer, Ani Yoreid Chila Layam, Veze Omer, Ani Yoreid Chila Layam. This one wanted the honor of jumping into the sea first, and that one wanted the honor of jumping into the sea first. Kafat shivto shel Binyamin, but in fact the shevet of Binyamin bursts forth, v'yared layam tchila, and they jump into the yam first. Shnei amar, as it says in Tehillim Perek Samach Ches, sham Binyamin sa'ir rodim. There, Binyamin, the littlest, the youngest, rodim, he ruled, because he took the initiative to jump into the waters first. Al tikri rodim, don't read it as rodim, that he ruled, ela reid yam. rather that he descended into the waters. So in other words, Gemara is having a little bit of wordplay. The word that, the way we should interpret this piece of Tehillim is not Rodim, that he ruled, but in fact we can ask, how was he Rodim? Because Raid Yam. If we break up the word, we see that he entered the Yam first. V'hayu Sari Yehuda Rog Mimasam. But the Sari, the leaders of Shevet Yehuda, were very peeved, and they started to stone him as a result of his initiative taking and taking away this honor from them. Shene Amar, Tilim Samachas, Sari Yehuda Rigmasam. Sari Yehuda stoned them. The princes of Yehuda stoned them. Lefichach Zachah Binyamin HaTzadik, V'na'aseh Ushpizchan Legvura. And he was chosen. Now, what was Binyamin's reward for having done this at the sea? He became the host to the Gvura of Hashem. Shene Emar, what does this mean in Devarim Lamed Gimel? It says, Ubein Ktefav Shachin. And between his shoulders, Hashem's Shlina rested. Which, what does that mean? It means that the Kodesh Kedushin actually rests in the Nachla, in the lot of lands of Shevet Binyamin. Amar lo Rabbi Yehuda. But Rabbi Yehuda has a very different interpretation of what precisely happened at the Yam. Lo kachaya hamaisa. This is not what happened. Ela ze omer ani, ein ani yoreid tchila layam. Veze omer ein ani yoreid tchila layam. Rabbi Yehuda has a less positive image of what was going down in the nation at this time. He said it was chaos, and everyone was vying not to be the first to go. Nobody wanted to do this harebrained, insane thing of jumping into a raging sea. Kafat, Nachshon ben Aminadav, but then here comes our hero, Nachshon ben Aminadav breaks forth, v'yarad layam tchila, and he descends into the waters first. Shene Amar, as it says in Sefer Hoshea Yabez, Svavuni b'chachash Ephraim uv'mir mabeis Yisrael v'Yehuda od rod im kel. At that time, I was surrounded by the deceit of Ephraim and the trickery of Beis Yisrael, meaning everyone was posturing. They were, you know, sort of showing their bravery. They were coming near the edge of the water, but it was all, you know, smoke and mirrors. There was nothing substantive to it. But Yehuda owed road in Kel. But Yehuda, Shevet Yehuda, of which Nachshon ben Aminadav was a part, he showed the true bravery. Owed road in Kel, he led with God. Now, the Gemara at this point does not indulge in any of that wordplay that it did three sentences ago, al tikri rodim ela reid yam. It doesn't do that like it did for Binyamin, so if I may, I'm going to extrapolate and do so myself. And, you know, before I get excited with my own little bit of Talmudic innovation, I've been burned before. I think I thought of something, and then I for sure see it that someone far holier than I has said this before me. So I'm not getting excited. It's just that I was too lazy to keep looking for the person who really said this. That being said, I once was at a shiur by Rabbi Jonathan Rosenblatt, and it was this brilliant interpretation of something in the Gemara, and he says, and I thought of that. And then he offsets this remark by saying, and I just didn't want to keep looking for someone else who also thought of that, so I'm keeping it as mine. So Rabbi Rosenblatt is entitled to such innovation. I am not so positive as to my own innovation, but what I would like to say is that we can also use a wordplay here, the Yehuda owed raid in Kel. He too went down, rode the Lashon of leadership, but raid the Lashon of Yerida, of going down. At this point, he descends into the raging sea in front of him, in Kel, with the name of Hashem. Now, this is supported by the next couple phrases, the Alav Mefaresh v'Kabbalah, and on him, meaning on Nachshon ben Aminadav, we are taught in Tehillim Samach Tes, Hoshieni Elokim ki ba'u mayim ad nefesh. Now, I've actually, in source number 4, quoted the full parak of Tehillim Perek Samates. We're not going to through it line by line. It is a very, very magnificent tefillah, though. And what the Gemara is saying here, what actually an interpretation of the Gemara here claims, is that actually it was Nachshon ben Aminadav who himself authors this particular parak of Tehillim. And these were the words that he recited raid in Kel. As he was descending into this raging sea, he was saying this tefillah, which later becomes Tehillim Perach Samach Tes. Now, what I found very interesting about this Gemara, and something that was absolutely new to me, was the fact that my image of Nachshon ben Aminadab apparently was a very westernized image of what it means to be a hero. The stoic, silent, great hero, doesn't consult with anyone, doesn't really talk to anyone, bravely, you know, is the thinking head, the cool head in the midst of the chaos and the anger, you know, plunges into the sea headlong without thinking, you know, with nary a result, you know, nothing will happen to me. And he, like, bravely walks in. But what this Gemara is telling us, and if you read this actual parak of Samach Tes, or Tehillim, it's a very, very different portrait. This is a man who is utterly terrified. He realizes that what he is doing is lunacy. He's crazy. I mean, it makes no sense. There's no other option. You can't exactly turn around and fight this gigantic army bearing down on you. But at the same time, Hoshieni Elokim Kiva Umayim Ad Nefesh, another medrash says that he waded in up until his nostrils before the sea actually split. And he was utterly terrified at every moment. Tavati Bivein Mitzula Ve'ein Ma'amad. He had no strong footing. There was just mud on the bottom of this sea. It goes on, skip a few words. Al tishpeteni shibolas mayem ve'al tivla'eni netula. And he's davening, don't swallow me up, the depths of the sea. He was absolutely afraid for his life, which of course makes this act of bravery, in a sense, so much more human and something that we can relate to in so much more of a great way. Now, okay, Uba Osa Sha'a Haya Moshe Ma'arach Batzila. Now, while this is happening with whichever nation, but we're going to go with the Nachshon interpretation, with Nachshon ben Aminadab jumping into the sea, with all the others yelling and fighting and screaming, Moshe Ma'arach Batzila. Moshe apparently is standing in Tzila. Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and Hashem says to him, Yedidai Tovim Bayam. Va'ata Ma'arach Batzila Lefanai. My dear ones are drowning in the sea, and you're standing here davening to me? Amar lefanav, ribono shalom. So Moshe Rabbeinu says to him, ribono shalom, umah biyadai lasos. But what can I do? Amar lo, shemos yadalid, which is Parshas B'Shalach, daber al b'nei Yisrael v'yisu. Tell b'nei Yisrael to march forward. Va'ata harim es matcha uneteyes yadcha v'gomer. The pasuk we just read, get the people moving forward and split the sea. Lift your matzah. The matzah had always been the agent of the miracles in the past in Egypt, and now it too, it once again will appear as the agent of the miracle right now. And actually, that sort of makes the miracle make a little bit more sense. Like, was it Nachshon who split the sea, or was it Moshe and his matzah who split the sea? So apparently, according to this Gemara, Nachshon is the one wading in. Shevet Yehuda is following him. Moshe is davening. Hashem turns him around from the act of davening, says, get the stick, my people are drowning, hit the water. So we can understand that Nachshon is slowly wading in. He gets up to his nostrils, at which point Moshe must hit the sea splits, and the rest is history. Okay. Shene'emar, l'fichach, this is the second to last line, second word in, l'fichach, zachayich Yehuda l'asos memshala b'Yisrael. And therefore, Yehuda was worthy of becoming the leader of Israel. Shene'emar, as it says in Tehillim Kof Yadalit, haisa Yehuda l'kadsho Yisrael mamshlosav. Yehuda was Makadesh Shem Shamayim, is one interpretation of that, where Yehuda becomes my sanctified, my separate one, Yisrael Mamshalasav, and the rest of Bnei Yisrael become his, Yehuda's, dominions. He becomes the ruler. Matam Haisa Yehuda Lakacha Yisrael Mamshalasav. And what is the reason why Yehuda becomes the leader, that he's chosen to be the leader? Mishum Tehayam Ra'avayanos. because he made the Kiddush Hashem, he made the, he, Nachshon ben Aminadav, at Kriyas HaYamsof, made the Yam split into two. Now, I've also, in source number 5, quoted the full Perek, Tehillim Perek Kuf Yod Daled, which is the Perek of Tehillim that we're familiar with from the prayer of Hallel. B'tzeit Yisrael Mimitzrayim, B'tzeit Yaakov Me'emloiz. This is a recitation about this episode of when Bnei Yisrael were leaving Mitzrayim, Pasuk Beis, Ha'isa Yehuda L'kacho Yisrael Mamshal Asav. Yehuda distinguishes himself, and the rest of Yisrael becomes his dominions. So the question on that parak of Tehillim is, at what point in the Exodus story does Yehuda distinguish himself, and therefore is Zocha to become the king of all of Israel? And the answer is this episode of Nachshon ben Aminadab. And Nachama Leibowitz also brings down this Gemara, actually, and brings down this episode of Nachshon ben Aminadav, and says, so magnificent and so great was this act of courage on the part of Nachshon ben Aminadav that the entire Shevet Yehuda for all eternity is meritorious of becoming the kings of Klal Yisrael. They showed the very essence of what it means to be leaders. In fact, there is a discussion in the Sefer Mesha Chachma about the character traits of a king and what it takes to become a king. And the Mesha Chachma uses this episode of Nachshon ben Aminadav to discuss at length this concept of keeping your head in chaos, of privileging intellect over emotion. This is the very distinguishing factor of what it means to be a king. Now, my question, though, not to take away from Nachshon and this great act, you know, that he does, could this really be the only thing that Shevet Yehuda has done in order to deserve becoming the kings of Klal Yisrael? Is this really the only act that makes them be meritorious of the Davidic dynasty? Now, I have to admit, my question isn't necessarily going to answer, my shir is not necessarily going to answer this question, but what my shir will do is sort of contextualize this singular act of Nachshon, and frankly, this is almost the only thing we know about the life of Nachshon ben Aminadav. But what I would like to do in the rest of this year is answer by saying, no, this is not the only thing that Shevet Yehuda as a whole had done in order to deserve kingship. But in fact, what Nachshon did was characteristic of what others within Shevet Yehuda had done, including Yehuda himself, the son of Yaakov, and that Nachshon is just part of the continuum of the Shevet Yehuda and of the Midos of Shevet Yehuda, which makes all of them collectively deserve to be chosen to be the kings of Bnei Yisrael, by contrast to the other brothers who never exhibited this type of behavior. Now, first we have to just for a moment analyze and give a name to what exactly this courage was. Let's be a little more specific. So, what I choose to call this act is initiative, taking initiative. Now, I once had the honor, but also maybe it was an error, to give this shiur, a form of this shiur, several years ago in the home of Rav Goldbach. So of course it was an honor, but of course it was an error, because 10 minutes before showtime, Rav Goldbach saunters over to me, so Elisheva, what are you speaking about? And I'm like, yeah, whatever. I didn't want to talk about it with him because I didn't want him to tell me all the sources I was missing, all the things I should be saying. And of course he gets it out of me, what's the topic? He then starts to give me exactly that, all the sources well, it's not going to be a shiur unless you have this source and that. Well, how could you even speak about this subject without this and that? So, whatever. But it's wonderful to learn from Rav Goldbach. And one thing that he did give me, though, that stuck with me in all the many versions as this shiur has evolved over the years, is that he, of course, rejected out of hands my English word for this character trait, initiative, and he gave me a beautiful Hebrew word for this character trait instead. And he calls this the Mida of Takifut. And we know this word, Unasana Tokef. We know this from the Tfil, Unasana Tokef Kedushas Hayom, a prayer that we say on Yom Kippur. We say, let us recite the greatness of the holiness of this day. Greatness is I think, a bad translation of the word takifut. And what Rav Goldrust was really paralleling was my word of a singular act of strength, a very unique type of strength. There are a lot of strong figures in the Tanakh. There are a lot of people who act, but they're not necessarily thinking things through. Remember, it's the Meshach Chachma's interpretation of privileging the intellect over the emotion. There's a calculatedness to this act. It's not my swashbuckling Western hero who plunges headlong into the river bank. No, no. This is someone who thinks things through but acts quickly, who takes matters into his hands and understands that there is no alternative but to act precisely in this way in order to be Mekadesh Shem Shamayim. This is the Midah of Takifut. Now, before I gave this year, I decided just for fun to Google the words Nachshon Ben Aminadav on the internet. And aside from all of the ridiculous stuff that I got on all of my hits, I got one delicious little resource, reference. I don't know if it's true or not because I don't speak any Yiddish, but apparently, and if there are Yiddish speakers in the audience, you can tell me if this is true, apparently there is a Yiddish expression to be a Nachshon. And this means to be an initiative taker. So I thought that was just a delicious little Google source for our shiur. And to be an Nachshon is the concept of what we're talking about, to be an initiative taker. Now, incidentally, just as a PS, Nachshon himself is rewarded for his own act of bravery in his own lifetime. Later on, by the dedication ceremony of the Mishkan, he is given the honor, he becomes the Nasi, the prince of the Shevet of Yehuda, and he is given the honor of giving the first set of karbanos, the first set of dedication presents for the Mishkan. But the kingship, which lasts for all eternity, is the subject of the shiur that I would like to discuss today, of this, you know, this act of initiative taking, or takifut, that Nachshon exhibits. What I would like to prove to you today and share with you today is something characteristic of his own ancestor Yehuda and of his future generations, including David HaMelech, who is the very author, incidentally, of this Perek of Tehillim, Perek of Yadalid, which says it was my great-great-great-grandfather Nachshon's singular act of initiative-taking which created the whole Davidic dynasty. But David himself was no stranger to these acts of takifut. Now, realistically, today we will only have time to analyze how this takifut is made manifest in the life of Yehuda, but hopefully I'll give you enough skills and set you up with enough ways to analyze the life of David. I included one episode of his courage and bravery, the episode of Goliath, at the end of this year, and hopefully you can carry these ideas and make your own analysis afterwards. But let's start with Yehuda. And let's try and understand where and when does Yehuda distinguish himself from the other brothers, Shevet Yehuda, and how does he, at the end of Yaakov's life, look at source number 3, it's already designated at that time, in source number 3, that Yehuda essentially is the king, will become the king of Bnei Yisrael. In Pasuk Ches, the first Pasuk, those 5 Pesukim represent the bracha that Yaakov Avinu gives to Yehuda on his deathbed. Yehuda, ata yoducha achicha. Yehuda, you are known by your brothers. Yatcha be'erif aivecha, you know how to conquer your enemies. Yishtachavu lecha b'nei aivecha. Your father's sons will bow down to you, which is as close a designation, a declaration of you will be the king of all of my sons as we get from all of the brachos and within all of the texts. Essentially, Yaakov Avinu has chosen Yehuda to become the king of Bnei Yisrael. So, the question is, we have to hark back into the life of Yehuda to understand at what point did this all begin? At what point does Yehuda start earning the respect of his brothers and of his father? Look at source number 6. It all begins during the Mechiras Yosef. The brothers form a murderous mob. They have all determined that it is halachically permissible, it is even their imperative that they must murder Yosef. But then, suddenly, source number 6, we have Vayomer Yehuda el Achav. Yehuda says to his brothers, Ma betza ki naharog asachinu? What really is the use value of us killing our brother? V'chisinu es damo, and we're just going to have to hide his blood and hide this crime. So he is sort of the beginning of the end of this, you know, scheme of theirs to murder Yosef. And he says, you know what? Let's sell him instead. Let's have our hands a little more clean, not, you know, full of the blood of our brother directly. Then, after they return with the Kasonas Pasim of Yosef and prove to Yaakov that Yosef has been murdered, and after they are incapable of consoling Yaakov, and the brothers collectively realize what an unmitigated disaster this whole, you know, selling off of Yosef was, and what a grave, grave error they have made, what a tremendous chait they have done. What happens is, the psukim tell us in this whole episode of Mechiras Yosef, and really the story of Yosef, Vayehi Be'esahi, this is the second source in number 6, Vayehi Be'esahi, Vayered Yehuda Me'esachav. Yehuda goes down from amongst his brothers, Vayet Ad Ish Udalami Ushamochira. You know, according to Pshat, it means he moved away. He took a little break and he moved away from the family unit. And then, you know, he goes on a little bit with his life and the Maisa Tamar. Now, let's keep in mind this word, Vayered, the Yerida. Okay? First of all, you can just contrast it in your head to the Yerida we were talking about before, the Yerida of Nachshon ben Aminadab, the descending into the Yamsa. Okay? For both figures, there is a Yerida which must come prior to an Aliyah, to an ascension. Now, the metaphoric reading of the literal reading of the Yerida of Nachshon was a physical descending into the waters. The metaphorical reading, the symbolic reading of Yehuda's Yerida here is not just that he moved away from his brothers, but that he lost a little bit of his estimation. He lost a little bit of his stature. And read the Rashi there, Vayehi Ba'is Aleph, Vayehi Ba'is Ahi. Rashi asks, Lama Nismacha Parsha Zulakan? Why suddenly are we talking about this little episode of Yehuda moving away from his brothers, the Hifsikba Parsha Social Yosef? We're interrupting the story of Yosef. L'lamed Shehu Riduhu Echav Migdulaso, to teach us that the other Shvatim lowered Yosef from his position of greatness, Kishara'u B'tzaras Avihem. When they saw the inconsolable grief of their father, they decided, essentially, to blame Yehuda. So they demoted him in his stature. Amru, and they said, Ata amarta lemachro, you Yehuda told us to sell him instead of to kill him. Ilu amarta, had you said laheshivo, had you said to return him altogether, to reinstate him altogether, to not do anything to Yosef, hayinu shomim macha, we would have listened to you. So in other words, they blame this entire episode on Yehuda. Now, I must admit, I've had a very long relationship with this Rashi, and it always, always bothered me. And I always felt the injustice of this. How could the brothers blame Yehuda? He, you know, was just a volunteer. It wasn't his responsibility to re-strategize the plan. Why does he get blamed to the point that he's so shamed, that he's demoted in estimation, and he has to flee, he has to move away and relocate? And I never understood it until certain life experiences taught me that the rule in life is, if you have a leadership personality, and if you take the initiative, and if you think of something, and it's your brainchild, guess what? You're in charge. And you will be held responsible for this, whether it fails, as their plan did, and even when something succeeds, if it was your idea and something succeeds, as the leader and in the position of leadership, you will be criticized. And that is simply the rule of leadership. And that's the way it goes for Yehuda. I have learned this from bitter experience. So now I understand this Rashi, and I understand why the brothers were entitled to hold Yehuda responsible for the failure of their plan. Now, Yehuda understands this as well. He is well aware of his own culpability in the entire Mechiras Yosef. He carries it with him his entire life. And later on, when it comes time for the brothers to band together to save their family from the famine that hits the land of Canaan and travel to Mitzrayim, where there are storehouses of food, Yehuda realizes that he's the man who's in charge of keeping the family unit together. So we have a fast forward in Source number 7. This is in Parshas Miketz. What happens is the brothers have already made one trip to Egypt, and they've already been suspected of spying, and they're already encountering this very mysterious and strange viceroy of Egypt, whom they don't know is Yosef, their brother, and they're already having a lot of tzaras in the procurement of food. And it is at this moment that this source opens, where they're down Yosef from years and years ago, at least 20 years ago, and they're also down Shimon. Shimon was taken as collateral at this point by this viceroy of Egypt because they were caught, they were suspected of spying. And the viceroy makes a deal with them, bring this little brother that you keep talking about, who is Binyamin, and show me him, and I'll exchange Shimon for Binyamin. So of course, you know, they can't do this. They've already lost Yosef for Yaakov. They cannot now sacrifice the life of Binyamin in order to save Shimon. But Yaakov is utterly distraught at this time. He is totally destroyed. He's like, what is going on here? I've lost one son. Now I've lost another son, Shimon. We have to have a plan. Similar to Bnei Yisrael at the Yam Suf, there is total chaos. There is total panic. There is a contention. No one is making any sense. Reuven pipes up with this plan. Oh, I guarantee that I will, you know, ensure the life of Binyamin, that it is not sacrificed. And what's the promise that Reuven makes? Just a couple of seconds before our action opens here. Reuven says to Yaakov, I guarantee that I will return to you both Shimon and Binyamin, and if I don't, you can kill my two sons. And Yaakov rejects his plan out of hand. What kind of offer is that? I'm down two sons, now I should be down two grandsons too? And then Yehuda pipes up, he interjects and again distinguishes himself, this time once and for all, as the leader amongst his brothers. Look at source number 7, Pasuk Ches, Vayomer Yehuda el Yisrael Aviv, and Yehuda says to Yaakov his father, Shalcha hanar iti, send the boy, meaning Binyamin, with me, v'nakuma v'nacha v'nechye v'lo namos gam anachnu gam ata gam tapeinu. I'm guaranteeing him. I'm going to get us food. No one's going to die. We're all going to live. Pasuk Tes. Anochi e'evrenu miyadi v'tivakshenu imlo haviyosiv elacha. And if I don't succeed, v'hitzaktiv l'fanacha, and if I don't bring him back to you and represent him to you, v'chatasi lacha kol hayamim. What is Yehuda's guarantee, which is more acceptable than Reuven's guarantee? If I don't succeed in this mission, then I will be sinner to you, I'm translating literally, kol hayamim, for all of my days. It's a very enigmatic promise, and it's also very enigmatic why it is acceptable to Yaakov. Why does Yaakov accept this? And 2 psukim ago, he rejects out of hand Reuven's suggestion. So, in order to understand this, we're going to go into a little bit more of a drashic interpretation of the events that follow. Look at source number 8. This is the first pasuk of Parshas Vayigash, which is also, I should say just for a moment, Parshas Beshalach and Parshas Vayigash, I think, like in my estimation, are the two greatest cliffhanger parshios in the entire Torah. They're both a moment of chaos, a moment of panic, where there is an impending doom, impending death. The action stops right in the middle, and then begins the enactment of the Yeshua. Yeshua is Hashem. You know, just stand and behold the Yeshua is Hashem. So, Parshas Vayigash opens with this very dramatic opening, Vayigash Elav Yehuda. The brothers go back down, they have Binyamin in hand, Vayigash Elav Yehuda, and Yehuda approaches him, him being Yosef, or the Egyptian viceroy. Vayomer Biadoni. And he says to him, please, my master, Yedaber na abdecha, daber ba'azne Adoni, I am just your servant. I just want to say something to you. Va'al yichar apcha ba'avdecha. He says servant twice. I'm just lowly. Don't be angry with me. Ki kamocha kaparo. Because I respect you as much as I respect paro. Now, this pasuk is very, 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 very rich. First of all, the word Vayigash has a very fascinating and rich biblical history. And I've actually given a shiur similar to this on Parashat Vayigash, and I analyze many uses of the word Vayigash throughout the Torah. But the first use of the word Vayigash is by Abraham Avinu, after the Malachim, the three angels, emissaries of God, come to him. We have this word, and they give him different pieces of news. One of the pieces of news that they give him is that the city of Sodom will be destroyed. And the text automatically stops there. It sort of interrupts itself, this narrative of, Abraham hosting these malachim. And then suddenly, Vayigash, Abraham el Hashem. And Abraham approaches Hashem. And if you look at Rashi there, Rashi gives you a little biblical history of many uses of the word Vayigash. And Rashi, through his unbelievable computer mind, says there are three meanings to the word Vayigash based on these different sources that use the word Vayigash. The first meaning is one of tefillah. I approach you in an act of tefillah. Essentially, I'm asking you for a matana. Give me this for free, whatever the request is. Of course, at this time, Abraham is davening for the saving of the city of Sodom. He is so disturbed that an entire city and the face of humanity within that city will be wiped out that he actually petitions to God for this city, regardless of how many Rishon evildoers were in this city. So he's begging Hashem. The second type of usage of the word Vayigash is pius, lashon pius. It's appeasement, and we see that clearly here with Yehuda. It's the appeasing of the adversary. And the third type of Vayigash is the Vayigash of Nahama. And if you're not going to give me these things through my tefillos, give me for free, or my pius, my words of flattery and appeasement, ki kamocha kaparo, we know, translated by Rashi, is also a threat. I can take you down like I can take Paro down. There's an element of threat. And frankly, it's not that Abraham and his, contentiousness with God was that I'm going to take you down. No, but there was a chutzpah in Abraham's approach. Hashem has designated a plan. He's dispatched an emissary, a malach, to tell Abraham, this is the plan, the city of Sodom is going down. And it's so unbelievable how Abraham is ready to fight God on this declaration. And of course, in the end, he does lose. But we see those three elements in the Vayigash here of Yehuda. Now, as I said in the introduction, by profession, I am an architect. I'm just going to digress for one moment because this is a very interesting little anecdote. When I was in architecture school, the system of tests was not, you never took paper tests, grade tests. You had something called a review. And what you would do is you would take all your drawings and your models, you take the drawings, you would pin them up on a wall, and you take all your models, you put them on little stools and tables, and you would present your project to a panel of reviewers, more appropriately called critics. Now, these critics were either, famous architects or not famous architects or architecture professors, whoever they were, outside guests that were invited. They weren't your teacher from all along the whole semester, and they reviewed your project. Now, as can be imagined, this is a terrifying experience. It's a public forum. It's not the privacy of handing in your paper and it's just you and your teacher seeing the grades and the mistakes and whatnot of your paper. No, this is a public form of humiliation. And they want to toughen you up and they want this to be very public and very humiliating. Now, when I was in school, there was an Israeli woman who was there with me. And one day I said to her, what's the Hebrew word for review? And she says to me, hagasha. And I threw down the pencil and I said, whoever picked this word really knew what they were talking about, because this is it. I'm begging these people, I'm using appeasing language, and goodness knows if they're gonna criticize me and attack me, I'm gonna fight back. So here it was, me enacting and living my own act of, my own instance, my own episode of Vayigash, Hagasha. Now, turn the page to source number 9. And as I said before, we're going to interpret this pasuk, or actually the first 6 words of this pasuk, in a more drashic way. And we're going to use a sefer written by the Vilna Gaon al HaTorah. It's a beautiful sefer, very complex, as is all the thinking of the Vilna Gaon. And what I'm going to do, I guess because of the sake of time, I'm going to just well, I don't know if I can see it as nicely as he does. Okay, let's read it. Okay. He takes these six first words of this pasuk, Vayigash Elav Yehuda, Vayomer Biyazani, and what he does is he analyzes the truck, or what he calls the neginos ahamilos, the start of his drash there. The truck, as you know, we lane every single week Torah in Shul. And there is, you know, these, the incantations, the musical notes, so to speak, of the words are called truck. I don't know what the Hebrew word is. Apparently, this source, this is not written by the Vilna Gaon by himself. It's someone who wrote the Sefer of, you know, he calls it Pnine HaGra, you know, just ideas from the Gra. So this author says that it's the musical notes, so to speak, that guide the reader how to pronounce, how to sing-song the words. Now, each one of these musical notes actually has a name. And the names of the six musical notes that appear above and beneath these six words are the following. So read along with me in the source. Haneginos al hamilos halalu, these musical notes are kadma v'azva. So there's a kadma symbol over the vayigash, there's an azva symbol over the elav. Revi'i, there's a revi'i symbol under the Yehuda. Zarka munach segol. V'shamati omrim b'shem ha'gra zal mevilna lafarish ha'maneginos ha'ele. Okay, now what the Vilna Gaon used to do regularly, this was common for him, is that he would read meaning in these symbols as they relate to the word that they appear over. So what the Vilna Gaon does is, he sees an idea communicated through the symbols of the truck and these words. Okay, Lamala, the Parshas Miketz Kasuv, before in Parshas Miketz it was written, Sha'amar Yehuda LaYakov Aviv, Im Lo Heviosi Veila, V'Hitzaktiv Lefanecha, V'Chatasi Lecha Chal Hayamin. This was his promise that we just read in the text. If I don't reinstate Binyamin to you, V'Chatasi Lecha Chal Hayamin, I will be a sinner to you for all my days, for all my living days. So we ask the question then, what does this mean? What is that kind of a promise? The Isa ben Midrash, skip the parentheses, v'chatati l'cha kal hayamim, haynu l'olam haba. What Yehuda is promising Yaakov Avinu is that if I don't succeed, I will give up my spot in olam haba, and that is acceptable to Yaakov. Okay, remember, what did Reuven promise? Then you can kill my two sons. How precisely is that going to help this grandfather who lost two sons already? He doesn't want to see more death in his life. But somehow the fact that Yehuda is willing to sacrifice such a tremendous thing, his olam haba, his spot in olam haba, v'chatas v'cha kol hayamim, is an acceptable plan to Yaakov. Now why is it acceptable? Not because it was acceptable to him that Yehuda wouldn't have a place in olam haba, but it's acceptable to him because he realizes this is such a tremendous sacrifice. The stakes are so, so high, Yehuda is just not going to mess up. He is going to succeed because there's no way that he could actually sacrifice this, and yet, perhaps. Okay, Davar Zemurumas B'Tame HaNeginos HaNe'amar L'mala. This is actually hinted at in the Tame Neginos, in the names of these musical notes. Kadma V'Azla Revi'i, which I'm going to translate with Rasa Lomar, Lama Kadam V'Azal El Yosef HaRevi'i Labanim. So why did the fourth, the Revi'i, Yehuda, who was the fourth son, be the one to approach Yosef? Kadam V'Azal, come forth. Shehu Yehuda, okay. V'Seder Todo Son Haya Reuven Shimon Levi Yehuda, he's proving that he's the fourth son. V'Lecho Rehevi Leila Reuven Likanis. Really, it should have been Reuven's job, the eldest son, the Bachar, Hakore Avor Binyamin, to fight for the littlest son, Dahavi Bachar, Dehu HaBachar, because Reuven was the Bachar, below Yehuda. It wasn't Yehuda, he was the fourth son, Shehu Revi Lavanim. Umefarish, and the answer is, Mishum, Dezarka Munach Segel. Because it was Yehuda who before, in Parshat Miketz, Zarka Munach Segel, Pirush, Dezarek es atmo milanoach betoch am haskula. Because it was he who had made that promise to cast aside his right to rest, manoch segal, milenoach betoch am hasgula, shapasak asatmo me'olam haba, etc. So in other words, this very drashic, very complex way of saying, Yehuda finally seizes an opportunity to do tshuva for the way he, you know, erred beforehand with Yosef. He had sacrificed the life of Yosef, he had lost him, and now the stakes are high. And in this moment of crisis, in this moment of panic, he is level-headed, he is calculated, he is showing his mitzvah of takifut, he is stepping forward with a rational plan that is slightly crazy. I mean, you must admit that jumping into the sea, no matter what kind of bitachon you are, is slightly crazy. That is part of the element of takifut. That is one important element of the mitzvah of takifut. But he is coming up with an acceptable plan, and in the end, he is successful. So what does he put on the table in order to convince his father? He puts his very spot in Olam Haba, on the line. And then later on, of course, the life of Yehuda concludes with that magnificent bracha from Yaakov Avinu. You are respected by your brothers. So he went through this Yerida. Now he is back on his Aliyah. He has earned this place of respect amongst his brothers. Generations later, it will be Nachshon ben Aminadab, who in a much shorter episode of his life, proves himself worthy of ascending to kingship, proves himself worthy of keeping his cool in a moment of chaos, having the best solution to the matter, which was not stam to argue and fight and compete, but just march forward, proves himself to be the leader in a leaderless void, and is successful. Just as a brief aside, a couple months ago, I came here and I spoke Erev Shavuos, and I spoke about Naani and Elimelech. And I started that shiur with the Medrash that asks, what was so, so terrible about the sin of Naani and Elimelech that they deserved such a strict punishment? Elimelech dies, the two sons die, and Naomi is left, you know, holding the bag. What did they do that was so horrific to be decimated in this way? And the Medrash there says, Naomi and Elimelech were both descendants from the Shevet Yehuda. They turned their back on Klal Yisrael in its time of need. There was a famine in the land, and they went off to go live their happy, rich lives in Moab. What Naomi and Elimelech did was not just some disgusting, but it was also an inverse of what there was pulsating through their very gene pool, through their blood. They should have known this lesson. Naomi was the granddaughter of Nachshon ben Aminadab. Could you imagine what he was thinking when his own granddaughter walks out on Klal Yisrael, when he was the one who walks forward with all of Klal Yisrael behind him? And the entire story of Megillas Rus is about how Naomi realizes what she did wrong, what her husband did wrong, but what's so magnificent about the story of Megillas Rus and the story of the life of Naomi is that she says, it's not too late to do tshuva. I can recreate kingship. I can recreate what made us worthy to begin with of being designated as kings, and indeed she does. She marries Rus off to Boaz. Boaz is a direct descendant of Shevet Yehuda. He was a generation below Naomi. I think Nachshon was his great-grandfather, or great-great-grandfather, I don't know. And she recreates Malchus, and we know that David HaMelech is the child that ultimately issues forth from this act of tshuva and of getting back onto the track of kingship, of takifut, of taking responsibility for the people, of leading the people, rather than abandoning the people. Now, as I said earlier, we won't have time to look at the life of David HaMelech, but it is interesting that David HaMelech comes onto the scene as a king, essentially. The burgeoning David HaMelech is really, you know, his leadership is born in the very private episode of him attacking the Ari and him attacking the dove in his path. But he sees that as just a message, a preparation for him ultimately to attack Goliath, the Plishti. And so what I've quoted here from Shmuel Aleph, Perek Yud Zayin, is this entire episode, which very similarly parallels the episode of Yetzias Mitzrayim, of Bnei Yisrael at this opening moment of Parshas B'Shalach, where Bnei Yisrael at that time are in a battle with the Plishtim. There's chaos, there's panic, there's this looming crazy giant enemy before them, and there is a void of leadership. Shaul HaMelech has no hero. He cannot produce a hero in order to attack Goliath the Plishti. And, you know, David, just b'mikra, by happenstance, is coming to visit his brothers, his elder brothers, who are in this battle, and he hears the giant booming voice of Goliath booming out these curses against God, and David, with this visceral, internal sense of yashras, of justice, and the fighter for Hashem and for the justice of Hashem's cause, is so disturbed. Who dares to be macharif and megadev Hashem like this? Who dares to speak of God like this and to curse Hashem? And this is the story of David stepping up to take the initiative, to take the leadership position, to fight this looming insane giant. And incidentally, with a lot of, with no support from his older brothers. His older brother Eliab actually yells at him and says, "Oh, I know your crazy ways. I know what you're trying to do. You're just the little dividel. You're trying to butt in with the big boys. I know what plan you're hatching." And yet he still fights this lack of support. He fights the fact that he's not a warrior. He wasn't even eligible to go to war. And he takes on this great giant. And of course, he is successful. Look on the last page, 5, Pasuk Mem, and just look at the last three words of Pasuk Mem. Vayigash el haplishti, and he approaches the plishti. So he knows very well this lesson of what the hagashah necessary is to ascend to kingship and to win the war of Hashem. Thank you.